Welcome to the Andy Noyes Experience, a podcast, endurance, noise, and random musings. And who do I have on the line today?
This is Nate Berg, Nathaniel Berg. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, good to see you. Where are you, Nate?
I'm up in Canada right now.
Okay, and you're on the East Coast then of Canada?
Yep, 3 hours ahead of you. So if it's 1 o'clock where you're at, it's 4 here.
Yeah, I thought you were in Canada, but when you said East Coast, and some reason in my head, I think you're on the West Coast, I guess, just because I think of you as a West Coast guy, because forever I've known you in California.
I've thought about it. I've thought about going to the West Coast. It's beautiful out there, but I'm here in Toronto. It's good for me. I've got no complaints.
Is Toronto where you've been most of the time since you've left California State?
Yeah, I left Bakersfield in 2007. And I've been up here predominantly in Toronto. I do spend like chunks of the year seeing my family in Florida, my mom and dad, down in the Northern Gulf Coast, which is a treat, right? But Toronto is my home. Yeah. So for the last 13 years, my office is here.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bakersfield and its weather, and it gets hot here, but it's humid here right now. Oh my gosh. Right. And it was so funny. We went walking, my Blanc and I, and we were bitching. And then we get home and we go, hey, oh, I won't say her name because it'll come on. And then we said, what's the humidity? And it's 35%. And then I asked, like, what's the humidity in Texas, Houston? And it's 80%. So, but it's supposed to be 113 here in Bakersfield. And it's pretty miserable. So it's just,
that's what I heard. Yeah. I heard it's pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be like 110 plus the whole week. But we've had really good weather. And then, of course, you know, it's just the Bakersfield's kind of changed. And so you ended up, how did you end up in Bakersfield to begin with? Were you born here and stuff?
I came to Bakersfield in 1984. And from England. It wasn't our first trip to California. We'd been there in the late 70s for like a year, but we went back to England, and then my dad got a good job offer in California. And that's where I went to junior high, Actis Junior High, and then I went to Garces starting in 86 and graduated in 1990, Garces Rams.
I often kind of chuckled that in Bakersfield we had a really great music scene, I really think, considering, you know, the size of the place and being Bakersfield, you know, being 2 hours from LA. But it's also interesting that the two main promoters in town both were Garces boys.
Well, is that Tim?
Yeah.
Bless him.
Yeah.
Tim got out of the game at probably the best possible time. As far as being a music promoter is concerned, you know, because music will always exist in one form or another. But at a certain point, it took off and became all about the festival shows, right? Yeah. That's where the action was at. So some of the mid-level promoters like Tim and others kind of their workload got really strenuous just to stay afloat. So, I mean, from what I understand, I mean, I'm not the Tim Gardea expert. He got some good bands to come through town. He got out at a certain time that where it was the right time. It was like that George Costanza thing on Seinfeld. I don't know if you watch Seinfeld.
Oh, yes,
where
yes.
George makes a joke in the boardroom, and it's like, okay, showmanship. I've made my joke. Now it's time to leave and walk out at the right time. So Tim kind of got out in 2010. Yeah. So I didn't know he was a Garces boy. That makes perfect sense.
the line was, the ocean called, they're out of shrimp.
Oh, you remember that, huh?
Oh yeah, I live on Seinfeld. So it's just really—it's very funny that I just thought of that when I was thinking about having you come on the show and stuff. And so you're at Garces, and you know, I went to Highland, so was very familiar with Garces. I graduated.
That's cool.
In 81. Well, I moved around a lot when I was a kid. My dad was in the military, and then computer industry. So I moved to Bakersfield when I was 14, but I probably went to like 3 or 4 elementary schools and two junior highs. And I came in 8th grade. And so I was bouncing around a lot, and I probably lost my point, but yeah. So when we would move though, we never had a lot of money, but my parents would always move me into the best school district. And when we moved to Bakersfield, it was Highland and West High, and they didn't like the West High area at all. And so that's why they picked Highland, and Highland's pretty small school, and worked out good. And so I got out of there at 81, then went to UC San Diego, and I ran into, and now, gosh, I wish I could remember his name. I worked a college radio station and record store down there, and the guy, he ended up hooking up with Def Jam, Rick Rubin and all that, and Perry Farrell, and he started promoting in college, and he ended up putting together Def America and Lollapalooza, Mark Geiger.
Oh, yeah?
Promoter. So I met him in 1982, 83, and he used to hang out. We had an independent record store on campus that you just worked for free, basically. And so I've always been kind of around the promoting business. I've also never gone near it.
Oh, yeah?
Because I don't have the mentality, the personality. And so I remember, you know, you coming in my store probably, I opened up in 86, 87, so probably that's about when we first ran into each other, I'd imagine, around them. Yeah.
And, well, your store, it's besides being a record store and getting in some cutting edge music, you threw a couple of shows, right?
And yes.
That era, 86, 87, was kind of very, very, what's the word, dry. Mm-hmm. We talk about it in the film because a lot of bands wouldn't come to Bakersfield out of fear of getting beat up and having their equipment stolen, right? So you were taking the chance, and you were getting some edgy bands, and you're getting some, you know, some kind of college rock bands, and like Angst played there, and you had the Examples play there, Love Rod Exchange. So you were performing. I mean, they were humble shows. I mean, I think the biggest show was like 50 people, but for a kid like me who was just getting a taste of punk rock music, right, coming out of the new wave 80s and getting a taste of that, it was, here's something that's new and cutting edge, and a guy's doing a free show, and we wanted more. We wanted more of that sort of scene. So you gave, you know, the kind of a really good taste of that at a time when it was dry. It was like 87 was a very dry year.
Yeah, what had happened was, you know, I graduated in UC San Diego and was a biology major, and quickly realized I wasn't smart or hard enough working to go to medical school. And so that's kind of why I worked at UC San Diego's radio station, blah, blah, blah. And then I ended up teaching in high school in Watts just to have a job, high school, but I was in the music scene. My girlfriend went to UCLA. And what kind of got my idea, I've always wanted to open up a record store for whatever reason, but there was a place, and it was called Texas Hotel Records or Motel Records. It was in Santa Monica, and it was a small little record shop that had bands play in it. And then down McCabe's Guitar Shop was also down the street. I don't know if you ever heard of McCabe's. Peter, you know, like they'd have like the Plimsolls, lead singer Peter Case would play there. They do kind of acoustic, and Texas Records, I think it's Texas Records, it had some sort of affiliation even with Henry Rollins. And so when I opened the store, I thought, hey, you know, we'll have bands play and just see how it goes, you know, to kind of promote the business. And also just, yeah, there was a void. There wasn't Jerry's or Bam Bam's, or there'd just be these one-off shows, like, you know, at the Fraternal Hall of whatever. And so what happened, though, is, you know, like we would get some out-of-town bands, and I'd always feel bad because we'd promote the hell out of it and get 10, 20 people. But then what was going on for us was, the local bands started getting crazy, and we were doing them during the daytime because I didn't want to have a night scene. And dusk. What's that?
It was dusk. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but the show that kind of put the dagger in me, and plus I think other people took over like legitimate real clubs, was, Scott Sturdivant, like Peter Will, was that the band when Scott Sturdivant and those guys, remember Scott had like a rock band?
Oh, like 97 Tears?
97 Tears. That's it. 97 Tears played my store on a Sunday, and hundreds of people showed up. And it got a little bit too insane. I mean, we pushed the record racks against the walls and let everybody in. Stealing back then wasn't as big an issue because it was all vinyl. But the parking lot, because there's nothing downtown, that parking lot was completely packed with cars. People were drinking, carousing. Even though it was like a Sunday afternoon, it was pretty nuts. And after that, after that, I was like, yeah, this, you know, the out of town bands, like I had the Swamp Zombies play. I don't know if you remember them. They were kind of like a psychobilly band with a stand up bass.
Oh, yeah.
And they came and they were on like Dr. Dream Records or something. And they were coming through. And I felt so bad. There was like me, my dad, and like two people I dragged in, you know, like five people watching them. You know, of course, the bands were always usually pretty cool, especially playing, you know, a store or something. So, and we had that band Fuck play.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. I'll share one with you. And I'll never forget this. It was David Keesh's band, Fantasy. Oh, yes. And they were like a proto glam rock band from the 80s. Very straightforward. Doing the spandex and the teased hair. And they were very unique characters, right? From Bakersfield, Oildale. I don't know where they're from.
Yeah,
but Oildale. I'll never forget their singer was like, the singer had the whole Def Leppard thing down, complete with the teased hair and the whole bullet belt and everything. And he was a blonde. And he brought out this acoustic guitar on their last song. And he wanted to do the whole Pete Townsend thing where he wanted to smash it on the floor. And I swear to God, it took this guy probably about five or six swipes at smashing this guitar on the floor for whatever. And this guitar was not a big, like, heavy instrument. It looked like it was made out of
matches. It was in the window. Yeah. It was in the store for the rest of the time the store's on 19th Street.
Yeah. He couldn't even smash it, right? And it wasn't that tough of a guitar. It was just dumb luck, right?
Rock. They had that. Their big hit was Rock with the Boys.
Yeah.
And that lead singer I often saw hanging out at Yokins Park.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Beach Park.
I'm not going there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But hey. That, you know, it's really kind of ironic and sad because I do a lot of social media and you yourself with, we'll eventually get to the Bones of Brundage. But it sucks that, like, I literally have no photos or anything of my store. I had cameras, but then it was film and I was always cheap and it was a pain in the ass. And so I never took any pictures. The only video or anything I know of is the Fantasy guys, because they documented everything. You can go on YouTube and it's under Then What Records, and that show is online.
Yeah. Like 10, I got 10 a snip of it. I got a snip of it at the end of the film.
Oh yeah.
Just a second. Right?
That's about all. Yeah, they were just terrible. Sweethearts of the guys, the bass player and guitar brothers, they were brothers. And then, of course, you remember the drummer.
Who was the drummer? It was a mystery guy. I always thought it was Chris Coles.
Yes, it was.
Oh, no shit. The secret's out now.
Yeah. They went through drummers like Spinal Tap. You know, they had tons of drummers, and so Chris played with the mask on or whatever, but that's why they sounded half decent, because you get a good drummer, you can hide a lot of.
Chris is amazing. He's an amazing drummer. I'm wondering about the mask, if the mask was his idea, because he didn't want to let people know he was actually in this band.
No, he didn't want people to know. I think we can let the bag cat out of the bag. It's been 30 plus years, which is amazing that it's been 30 plus years. Nate's like, wow. You're looking really good, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking, you know, because how old are you?
I'm 48. Yeah.
Anyway, 48. I'm in the running world, and we all know each other's age and ask each other's age because there's all these age group things. So for us, it's like, and we can just go online and go, oh, Andy's 57. so I always just hit up people. So, and speaking of that, you know, I really enjoy you posting, kind of talking about how I have nothing from my business when I had a store basically for about 20 years. The last four or five were pretty much just places to buy stuff to sell on the internet. But you can be able to curate and force people who've been sending it to you too. And I really enjoy all the old photos and things that you've been posting. And you've got a big treasure trove of that stuff, I guess, flyers and things.
Well, I've got some of my own, but it's kind of interesting that more of this project has kind of progressed. The more people have come out of the woodwork and say, here's some photos. So I kind of grab the ones that I want to use. Right. Because it's all about the angle and the quality. I don't want to put up a poster, a flyer or a picture where the picture's not that interesting, bad angle, unflattering to the subject. Yeah. So I trim it, I treat it, whatever I got, and I grab the best ones, right? And because of that, it kind of, I mean, it's not about me, it's about the picture anyhow. Other people come forward and say, like today, for instance, I got a message from Scott Graham from Chaotic Evil. And he said, dude, amazing job posting these pictures. Love watching them. Here's some pictures of me performing in Chaotic Evil and my brother who played the drums. Now, this is great because I don't have any pictures of Chaotic Evil. And that band was like, when I was coming up in 87, Yeah, they owned this town, right?
Oh, they were amazing. I mean, just truly amazing.
That whole genre of, like, punk that kind of crossed over into metal, like DRI, Anthrax, Crumbsuckers, Agnostic Front. It was that era. So, you know, a band like Chaotic Evil playing a show brought out the mosh pits and brought out the people, right? So it was great because I had no pictures of Chaotic Evil. I never thought I ever would. And then today, I was just going down to the grocery store. I got a message from Scott, and he sent me like 4 great pictures. So I'm going to put those in the feed. So it's like it's a snowball, right?
Well, that's what I meant. You're getting people are sending it. Now, are you actually archiving them on like Google Photos or something? Or doing something?
No, no. I'm just putting them in my phone and jamming them online. I'm a simple guy. Yeah. The more applications I have, the more I screw it up.
Yeah. Well, the best part is Google Photos, you put it on your phone and it automatically uploads all your photos to the cloud.
Yeah.
And then at some other time you could maybe let someone like me organize them. But what's great about it is it automatically uploads them. And so then they're always going to be somewhere in case your phone takes a crap. It's a pretty amazing technology, the Google Photos, you know, because I've been taking photos. That's what I'm saying. It's ironic. My store, of course, the technology wasn't about social. There wasn't a social media. There was flyers and zines and stuff. But I've been taking running photos in Kern County since 2006, and from probably about 2009 all the way to now, I've got tons of stuff. So I can put out, it's kind of what you do, just like, oh, every day I go, oh, here's something from, like I just posted did photos from a 2009 cross country meet with, and so some of the kids in those things now are married with kids. And so it's kind of fun to just be like, you know, kind of in a total different vein, but, and so that's why I would love to see you be able to, but yeah, you just put up Google Photos, the app on your phone, and then just click a couple buttons. And then what it does is just uploads all that stuff to the web. And then eventually, you know, you don't even need to organize it, but if it's just there, it would be awesome.
Consider. I'm such a, when it comes to technology, I'm such a primitive person. So,
yeah. Well, we got you on Zoom, and this is even easier. And speaking of that, in fact, we've been going on for a little while. Your documentary, Bones of Brundage, how it's amazing. I love being on Amazon. I'll let you go talk about it in a bit, but I wanted to tell you how I enjoyed when you called me up and I went down there and talked to you for a little bit and at Jerry's. But what I really loved about it was my wife, who was with a big part of the store early on until then we had kids, and then she stayed home. And well, she went back to, actually she didn't stay home. I raised the kids. I was Mr. Bob. She went back and got a county job so we could afford to insurance and all that stuff. That's one of the ways I stayed in business, was her having a real job. But what was really cool was my kids, the store kind of closed by the time they were 10 or 11 or 12, and they weren't really into music. My middle son's a huge music fanatic. But what was great about your movie is we all sat down, and very rarely happens except when there are kids watching Disney, and actually watched your documentary. And me and Blanca watched it and talked about it. And the kids asked us questions. My kids now are, you know, 27 and 28, but it was really kind of cool to we had a really great moment then. So I really appreciate you putting it together and appreciate that.
You're not the only person, who's actually said, look, I've had my kids watch this too. I get people that aren't even in the movie, just like people that went to the shows who watched the movie on Prime. And then they come to me and said, I sat my kids down. They've always wanted to know what sort of a child I was. So I made them watch the movie and now they get it. Right. So there's a lot of that going on, because not only is it a piece of entertainment, but it's also a little bit of closure for a lot of people, or a little bit of it's a historical document. But most important thing is, I believe it's honest, right? We're not sugarcoating Bakersfield. We're not making a tourist video to make people think, look, Bakersfield's a wonderful place to live. That's not what we're doing here, right? It's rowdy. It's out of control. And that kind of comes across in the music, the people, the characters, right? I mean, I feel kind of bad because I know we filmed you for about 35, 40 minutes and we got so much stuff out of you, and we ended up, and you're not the only one either, right?
Oh yeah, no, I totally, yeah.
And we ended up using about a minute of you, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, oh yeah. But it was a great minute though, Paul. It was a great minute, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, speaking about Bakersfield and Bakersfield badass mentality. Okay. You know what we're having here? We've always had, there's street racing always been going on in Bakersfield.
Yeah.
And now they're getting really crazy because we got that crosstown freeway that's pretty much wide open. And they're out there, hundreds of people showing up, street racing, carrying on. The police are trying to hunt them down. It isn't working. But here's my wife's goal, because she actually listens to the news. I don't. The street racers now, you know what they're doing? They're demanding from the city and the cops that they should be allowed to have a place to street race.
Oh, yeah? This is during the pandemic?
Yeah, right now.
Yeah?
This weekend. Yeah, but Bakersfield people are so badass. They're like, fuck the pandemic, fuck COVID. We want a street race. And, oh, you guys are going to try and catch us and stop us. Well, you know what? We're doing something. We're going to ask. We're demanding that you let us have a place to do this. Isn't that insane?
Like, isn't there an empty speedway somewhere? Isn't there one of those?
Yeah, we got quite a few of them, but that would cost money. No, I think they're demanding that they get a, you know, like, hey, we're going to close off this street so you guys can race cars up and down it.
But there you go.
But it's, you know, it's Bakersfield, so
bravado,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and so, but yeah, no, like, and so, how did the whole Bones of Brundage kind of come about? What was how did you decide to get into it, do it?
Well, I wanted to do a film about Bakersfield. I did a film before that was kind of like my demo tape, and that was about Fugazi. They played in Fresno, and we had this old footage, and I just drove around the country filming my friends, like maybe 10, 15 people, and Ian Mackay, one of them. So we made a film, and it has some, not so much mistakes, but it's the sort of film that you could see I was learning. So I wanted to do this film about Bakersfield. I knew there was a story here. And when we started to do it, it's like, one of the big mistakes I made is I actually started to make this film with no script. Now, how do you write a script for a documentary? Well, you know what the stories are. I mean, I knew the story about Todd Thompson. I knew the story about Ty Elam. I knew the stories about Jerry's Pizza in the 80s. I knew the stories, but how did they all kind of bounce together? Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a question of bringing all those stories into kind of like fusion. How do you do it? And the only thing I could do is my own recollection, because I was there in the 80s. Yep. I was there in the 90s. I started promoting at Jerry's in the 90s. I was there in Jerry's heyday, which was the early 2000s, when there was a van from out of state behind the club almost every other night, right? And then the other section was just present day. What is it like today? So I use my own experience and go out and get these stories. We filmed almost 10 hours of footage to make a movie that's an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? So, and we just ended up having to chisel and chisel and chisel. And I tell you, it was because of my ambition, or whatever you want to call it. I was overambitious. I had two other segments filmed for the movie, because the movie is like 8 segments, right? I had two other segments. One was about Valley Fever, right? The illness. And the other one was about country western music, but, you know, the Bakersfield sound. But we couldn't find a way to kind of make those two issues relevant to the story of the Bakersfield underground music scene, right? So I had to cut them out. And the country western segment would have been a whole nother hour, because you can't just briefly talk about these, you know, these guys that have paid their dues in like the country, the Bakersfield outlaw country scene. You can't just like mention them, you know, yet. So I said, no, that's another film.
Yeah. That was a wise move, not having those two, because I'm not an art film guy, but I hung around enough of them people. In fact, my girlfriend at UCLA, when I went to LA, was in that business. In fact, but you couldn't cram those two things into it, and they're definitely just more documentaries, so that's definitely cool. So
yeah, the Valley Fever segment was really good, because the lady that does the Valley Fever advocacy, she gave me a really great interview that was heartfelt, and it was very on point, but it just had nothing to do with the Bakersfield rock and roll thing. It emphasized how tough it was to live there, but you don't need to spend 20 minutes talking about, you know, a fungus, you know?
You know, speaking of stars, of course, Ty was awesome in it, and I've known Ty forever. You had him as a central character in the movie, and I think he really played real well in the film. It's kind of because he gave it also kind of a comedic kind of take too, you know what I mean?
Well, he was a great MC. We're talking about the early shows in the 80s. His own experience growing up, just being a little punker at 14, going to the shows with a stepdad, and then finally we got into it, right? I mean, it was a great interview. It was like a Sunday afternoon on his back porch, drinking IPAs, and it was just total classic Bakersfield in the sun, just going at it. All of us were sweating. Him, I, the producer, Chris was there running the cameras. And it was just, and he gave it his all. I mean, I don't think there's one part of his story we didn't use, right? Yeah. He was so on point, and he's got a great voice too.
Yes. You know, Ty. I mean, he spent many an afternoon hanging out at the store, and yeah, it just was very fun to watch that. Another thing that I noticed more like with the movie, but you're posting all these great Bones of Brundage, is just, and I'm sure you just noticed it, but just how many people aren't with us anymore. It's just stunning. They were, because we're not that old, and my gosh, it's crazy.
The large chunk of time. I mean, last week we lost four people, right? We lost Monty from My Increment, RB Contreras, Aaron Lehman from Guitar Center, and Brian Jones was murdered. He died, the drummer. He died last week. And well, and the fourth guy is my connection out in Vegas, Mike Talafrayan. He passed away as well. So, I mean, that's four people I know. And then there's other people that know four people that died, you know, in 1 week, right? And that's not pandemic related, or maybe it is. Yeah. I don't know.
But still, it's just shocking that so many of the Bakersfield music scene, you know, definitely are passing away left or right. Yeah.
We're not spring chickens anymore, right? That's number one. And rock and roll does have a tendency to attract a lot of bright lights that flame out pretty quick. Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it, make it sound so cold. I mean, I could say it's tragedy, and it is tragic, but there's a lot of things that go with rock and roll and the creative types that lend themselves to self-destruction.
Oh, almost definitely. And I grew up on the East Coast, and all my relatives lived into their late 90s. I mean, my three grandparents, one died in an accident, but the others made it to like high 90s. And so it was interesting that when I moved to Bakersfield when I was 14, kids would be like, oh, my granddad died. And I'd be like, we're 14. How old is your grandfather? 57. I was like, whoa. I was like, people die at 57? Because in my world, that was unheard of. Everyone I knew lived till 70. I mean, if you died at 70, that was like young. And I kind of thought, well, part of it's because of Bakersfield's hard reputation of, you know, people coming from Oklahoma and Texas and living hard and playing hard and the whole, in fact, this would be kind of a motif with your whole country thing, just that, you know, you bring all these scoundrels and, you know, wild people to town, kind of like the country of Australia. And so I really realized, like, wow, people are just, you know, people. And then also, like, just how large the families were. But yeah, I just kind of was struck by how many people have passed away. I mean, if you can't, almost, I'm like, for running total, it's just kind of, I think part of it, yeah, and it definitely is, you know, the whole artistic kind of thing. Definitely, you know, myself, I was never that way. So, you know, that's why I was never going to be very artistic. And also the thing with me is I never drank. I was through the whole music scene all the way from the beginning to the end. I've never drank my entire life, but I was out five nights a week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, drinking, it may or may not be a part of it because some people can drink and never have a health problem. What is telling is in the, and it's not that big of a deal anymore in the music industry in Bakersfield, but in Kern County in the late 90s, I'm saying 95 through 2002, heroin was very big, extremely big. So you saw a high number of people, local bright lights in the local music scene who were into that scene, whether they were fans or musicians or whatever, drop dead. I mean, I know a whole clique of people who unfortunately ran with the heroin and shooting up, that they're all gone.
Yeah, it's just definitely just one of the things that I just noticed with that. So you ended up getting, you did the Fugazi and then you did the Bones of Brundage and put it together. How long did it end up taking you guys to put the movie together? I remember it seemed to.
Well, it took a long time, but I kind of was learning along the way. I've got a great debt of gratitude I owe to my editor, Dan Moshe in Toronto, who actually kind of sat side by side with me and had tremendous patience. And we learned along the way. My producer keeps me in track with the story, but it took probably about from 2018, and then by the end of 2019, we actually released it online on Prime at the end of 2019. So it took probably a year and a half to make it, and then after we made it, we ran it online, and then we actually finally got it to Prime, And now we're trying to get it into the hands of a distributor. It's actually, I'm getting to the point now where it's out of my hands, right? When in the hands of a distributor, they're the ones that are going to be able to take it to the bigger channels like Hulu or Netflix or whatever, film fest. So as soon as it gets into the, I mean, they've got it. I just had to cut a new trailer the other day, and it was really strange cutting a new trailer that's rated G. They said, this trailer that you make has got to be rated G because it's going to be played everywhere, right? If we can get it everywhere. So I had to make a track, and I was looking at this footage, Paul. Do I call you Paul on here? Or is
yes,
Andy?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. So I was looking at this footage, and we made a great trailer, and it's rated G, and it was a challenge. How the hell do you make a documentary, The Bones of Brundage, and then have to make a trailer that's rated G about a movie that's about a hard town with violence and cussing? I mean, there were some people in my movie that cussed. I think they just showed up saying, I'm just going to cuss a whole bunch when we film my segment, because that's what Nate wants. He wants me to cuss.
Yeah.
Right? So we made this trailer, and it's rated G. But looking at the footage, I said, I have been staring at this footage, all these different cuts and all these different live snippets. And I've been moving them around. I've made like five trailers for different reasons. We made one for Prime. We're making a rated G one. So, and we made a film festival one, but all the film festivals are unfortunately on hold. Right. There's no film festivals this year. You know, we were getting started on that, and then the pandemic happened. And, you know, I'm doing okay. The film is the least of my problems. Other people have had it a lot tougher.
Yes.
But looking at the footage, I said, we've maxed out as much as we can get out of this. Here's your rated G trailer. Take us to the next level.
Yeah.
It's time for me to get some sleep.
Nice. Yeah. Move on. And so it's awesome that you're on Amazon Prime. Has it been pretty good to have the thing on there? And it seems like it's been doing well.
It's been a very silent success because it's, you know, in this world of online films, it's there for people to watch. They don't get to see the demographics, but there's two different approaches. And I've always been really hard about pushing it in Bakersfield. And this is where I feel very proud because obviously, everybody in the punk scene or the underground music scene is going to want to see it, whether they like it or don't, or whether they're pissed off that they're not in it, right? they're going to want to see it. But eventually, you run out of people in the music business.
Yes.
So now we're getting followed by like oil field workers, roofing contractors, office secretaries, people I know from junior high, your truckers. People who are just attracted to it because it's a low down, dirty Bakersfield, Kern County movie. And that's what I wanted the whole time. I didn't want to make a movie for the punk scene. I wanted to make a movie for Bakersfield because if you see Bakersfield in popular culture, it gets shit on, right? It gets shit. So I wanted to put a movie up on the screen and say, this is you, right? Warts and all, we're no sugar sprinkles, right? This is Bakersfield. So we're going to make this movie and this is for you because Bakersfield deserves a movie that's honest and dirty and low down, right? Now we're on Amazon. Now anybody can watch it, you know.
Yes,
so
most definitely.
My theory was what's the population of Bakersfield? All right,
500,000.
Half a million. If half of that, 250,000 people watch my movie, or our movie, because it's not just mine. If half of that, then that's what I'm shooting for. I'm shooting for 250,000. So I'm going to say we're probably at about 75,000 now. 75,000 different people have clicked on it. And some of these people don't even live in Bakersfield, right? Because you have a lot of people that moved away, right? They're just everywhere. And then now I'm getting people watching this movie from across the United States who just watched this movie because it was suggested to them, because they watched the Gigi Allen documentary. And at the bottom it says, if you like Gigi Allen, you may like Bones of Brundage. You know what I mean? So Prime has done a really good job, but it's a very silent victory because nobody gets to see the demographics. But I wouldn't be pushing it so hard and doing what I got to do if I didn't think we had legs. And it's not my success. The success belongs to every single person that's in it who actually gave it a chance. I mean, it took four different plane trips for me. I had to fly from Toronto to Bakersfield and back four times, but it was worth it.
Oh yeah.
All right.
Well, yeah. Like I said, it for me, and I've been the ultra running world. And I often tell when I'm out hiking and tell people to check it out, because actually I even wrote it in here that what the similarity between like the punk scene or just Bakersfield scene, the ultra scene, you know, it's kind of the Island of Misfit Toys, both scenes. A lot of people in the ultra world can relate to the punk world. A lot of them came out of that alternative world. But yeah, it's also like the Bakersfield thing. Like after I watched it, and I've been here long enough, you know, I went away to college for 3-4 years and I lived in LA for 2, but I came back in 87. And, you know, I'm kind of like one of those people now where, and watching your movie, just kind of like take pride in like, yeah, you know, this is a hard place and a hard town. And that's what I like about it. You know, I don't want it easy. And it's still, you know, shit goes on here that, you know, just you're amazed that goes on, but it's like, hey, that's how it is. And so, yeah, I think it'd be good. One of the things that's interesting, like in the ultra world, we often like same thing when you're punk, you think it's like the whole world, but it's this tiny little sliver. And so, yeah, you want to bust out. There's a guy named Laz who puts on these crazy races, and he has this one called Barkley Marathons. And it was just this kind of obscure race in Tennessee, but it finally caught fire. And now it's really big, but it's because it's a human story and relatable, like your movie. And so like this Barclays Marathon took fire, and now ordinary people, like if you're out in the public, people know 2 race ultras. They know Badwater and they know Barclays, because they're these extreme. Badwater, you run from Death Valley to Mount Whitney. And so that's the kind of same thing like with your movie. I can see that happening in terms of enough people start watching and going, hey, this is just a good movie, not just about Bakersfield, but just about people in a certain time and era. So I think it definitely, I'm glad to hear that you're keeping the, you know, the foot on the pedal, I guess is what, yeah, I would say.
Well, we're very lucky, because now is a very good time for documentaries. Yeah. Obviously the live music scene is on hold. The live sports world isn't questionable. Going out to clubs, restaurants. So people want to sit at home and they want to watch something, right? That was even the case before COVID-19, right? Yeah. A lot of people, their idea of a night out is just to stay home, smoke some pot, watch some Netflix, some Prime,
yeah,
Order Fudo or whatever. Get, you know, what do they call it when you get your food delivered to you? You know, and that's will be what the night, Friday night would look like. So documentary films are big regardless. And rock and roll documentary films specifically, because of the whole success of like the Queen movie, Bohemian Rhapsody, mm-hmm, which was, it was a drama, but people are, yeah, interested in the old scene because there's no more Freddie Mercury, you know? So yeah, they have to kind of reframe the legend that Freddie Mercury was. And if he's not putting out any new music, how about a movie about him? And that, yeah, movie spawned the Motley Crue movie, and that spawned the Elton John movie. Rock and roll is so interesting of a tapestry. The sad thing is, and this is one of the reasons why Bones of Brundage has been so successful nationwide, is because if you go to a place like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or Fresno, California, Stockton, or Gainesville, everywhere in the United States, there's these towns where there has been a tough music community,
oh, yeah,
from the 80s. So it's extremely relatable to people, yes, that live in other towns. If they could only get over their hate for Bakersfield. That's the thing. And yeah, Bakersfield does have 2 magic bullets. Cesario mentioned it to me, but when we were filming, it's not in the film, but he pointed out, and I like to repeat it, in the fact that Bakersfield has changed the map of music, commercial music, twice overall. And not too many, mm-hmm, towns can even claim that they've changed it once.
Yeah.
Bakersfield created the Bakersfield sound, which is tremendously respected in the country western circles, even in Nashville, there's a whole street dedicated to Bakersfield bars, right?
Yeah.
There's a place called Los Fresnos, Texas, where we were just sitting there in a diner about 12 miles out of El Paso, and they've got a whole diner, and it's all Bakersfield themed. They've got pictures of Union Avenue, pictures of the old clock tower, you know, and it's like you order your Mexican food. So there's this romance with Bakersfield country western. And the second time that Bakersfield has changed the music industry is obviously in the mid to late 90s with the aggressive hard rock, kind of new metal, and Korn is one of the progenitor, if that's what you want to call it.
Yep. Oh yeah.
You know, they were the first, and they're, I mean, if you want to name the top 3 or 4 big metal rock bands in the world, they would be in that number. So, you know, we do have this reputation, not just as being a city, like Fresno. I mean, I love Fresno. It's got more trees, it's got great food, great people, but I cannot think of one musical act from Fresno. right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's not me talking shit, you know. Oh, no, I got no, a lot totally. Of, I got a lot of Fresno friends, right?
I've never been a big fan of Fresno because to me it was just a bigger Bakersfield. You know, and so it was like, and it was, you know, further away from LA, and like when I first opened my store, I had a lot of people from the Fresno area come down to my store, and we had Fresno bands. So things, it's kind of like the town, Fresno was just a little too big. Bakersfield was just the right size that this kind of really took off. But speaking of corn especially, I mean, you know, I have an affinity for them. I used to substitute teach at Highland with Reggie and Jonathan and then all that. But what's amazing is like Big Mike. Remember Big Mike that used to work at my store? The big 6'6", 300-pound guy?
Oh, I've slept since then, Paul.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Well, he used to come in. He used to work the afternoon shifts in my store. And anyways, he was a huge metal guy. And he was a metal guy in that he loved Poison all the way to that scary Norwegian dark black metal. I mean, he liked the gamut. If it was metal, he loved it. And he was probably one of the guys that knew more about it. And so he used to make me order all these metal magazines and all this stuff. And you know what? All the metal magazines in that time period, it was Metallica and Korn. Korn, Metallica, yeah. Korn, Metallica. And so in Europe and England, Korn was just, it was bigger than Metallica. And here in America, they were big, but their influence in Asia and all around the world was just phenomenal, and I really respect it. It was awesome seeing Jonathan in your documentary and stuff like that. And you know,
well, he cares. He totally cares. He wanted to be part of this. Yeah, he was there when it happened, and he actually cares about how it was being presented. Right? Mm-hmm. He actually, you know, he was worried. He said, I'm getting calls from country western guys wondering about how bloated your film's going to be with, you know, how you're going to be able to tell the country western story. And at that point in time, I had already made peace with the fact that that's totally another movie, right? Yeah. So, you know, the thing with that band, with Korn, and this is what another thing that's telling about Bakersfield is we've talked about how Cesario brought up that Bakersfield has changed the landscape of music twice.
Oh,
but
yeah.
People in Bakersfield, it's almost as if they take that stuff for granted. Like, oh, yeah. they know that there's going to be somebody performing for brunch at the Crystal Palace on Sunday, every Sunday. So let's not go the Sunday, right? Whereas that sort of performance would be huge in Nashville, would be huge in Tulsa. A Bakersfield sound guy's getting, you know? So in Bakersfield, we just take things for granted. And same thing with a whole Korn nu metal thing, right? It's like, you know, it was big for a while, and now Korn has had to transform, not only spiritually, but also kind of musically as well, right? They're no longer these party animal crazy guys that they were in the 90s. They all have families and jobs, and they've all had life experiences. So, and yet that kind of comes across, right? So, but they'll never be, I mean, they'll always be a stadium packer, always.
Yeah.
They will always be a stadium band.
I think one of the reasons why you've had the success is because everybody's like, yeah, whatever, you know, and that makes the musicians and bands push even harder because we're like parents who don't pay attention to our kids. The music fans of Bakersfield, like, oh, you know, okay, yeah, well, you know, and never good enough. You're like, you know, just never give praise or give compliments. I mean, I told the story, I think, in the documentary, the classic time, one time, you know, I sold those gigantic posters, and I'd sell the Korn posters and Cure and everybody. But I remember one time, some, like, tweaker, homeless, semi-homeless, 30-something-year-old guy rolling up in the middle of the afternoon on his BMX bike, sticks his head in the door, and, you know, he sees a Korn poster, and he's like, man, they ain't shit. And you're like, dude, you're on a BMX bike at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Wednesday. You probably have $5 to your fucking name, and you're saying they're not shit. They're the big, yeah. But I mean, that's the attitude. They're always like, you know, this town is kind of like, you know, it's stick your head up above and you get hammered down. And you know that because you had some pretty rough times in the 80s and 90s being known and wandering around Bakersfield and, you know, being successful, but people also wanted to take shots at you.
Some of them I deserved, right? I got to own my side of the street. Yeah. Some of the hell I brought on myself, but there was also a lot of hell that I didn't bring on myself. I mean, I got jumped by a bunch of Nazi lowriders a couple of times. I mean, Bakersfield does have a lot of street gangs and all that sort of stuff. But it's funny because one of the prominent lines in our documentary that refers to Bakersfield just being a furnace of negative emotions. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, you got the heat, you have the high unemployment, you have the challenges, you have, a lot of the, you know, the reasons why Bakersfield's on this list of being one of the most questionable places to live, right?
Well, yeah, air and cold.
That, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's tough, right? So you get Mark De Leon pretty much opening the film saying Bakersfield hates, and Bakersfield hates those people from Bakersfield who have success. And that is is totally true. As off-putting as it sounds, it's also honest. It's so honest.
Yeah, no, it's completely true. And that's why we're successful, because of that hate. It's, you know, pressure makes diamonds.
Yeah. I mean, look.
And so we don't fawn over everybody like picks up a guitar. And so in a way, it's in a sick, perverted way, you know, it's kind of like, you know, having alcoholic parents makes a kid.
And that line, Paul, that line that Mark said, Bakersfield hates the people who have success. That line is actually a built-in defense against any criticism of this film project, because as soon as someone starts talking shit, you know, it's like, well, you know what, Bakersfield hates Bakersfield hates anybody who has success, right? So it's like case proven. This film actually defends against its own criticism. And when Mark said that, I knew I had gold. I said, that is so bang on the money, right? It's happened.
And he was great in the movie too. I mean, I've known Mark since he was 13, 14. He used to live in my store practically and through all that stuff. And then just the success he's had and all the things that he's done over then. Because when I first met him, I was thinking, you know, why isn't this kid in school? What in the world's ever going to happen to this kid? You know, I mean, he even ran for mayor.
He's done it all. He's done it all. And he got to hang out with his idols and Kiss. You know, he's got that van. He's got the tattoo business. He's in 1,000 bands, right? Yeah. He's got a lovely family. And he even though Bones of Brundage was not really Mark's story, because we didn't approach it from like, tell us what it was like when you're a kid.
Yeah.
Mark, we didn't do that way with Mark. Mark was like the unofficial master of ceremonies. We needed somebody who knew it all.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah.
Who was there for everything.
Yeah,
right.
Was.
And he didn't share too much about him personally because we didn't really ask him. We were just talking kind of about, you were there. I need your testimony. Right. Even down to like the cars, you know, driving around the circle, Father Garza's circle and going and cruising all the way down to Brundage Lane. That was like, we needed that. That's outside of the realm of punk, but that's what we needed to show what it was like and what the punk rockers were contending with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just on that point, early when I opened the store, like in 87, 88, I don't know how old Mark was, but he was pretty young. The Examples used to rehearse in my store briefly until it was just way too noisy and just didn't work. But the Examples got a gig up in Fresno, like in 88, 89 at some place. And Mark somehow talked his way into my car, and I took him up to the show sort of as a roadie when he was like,
wow, you were at that show?
Yeah. We went up there.
That was a notorious show. It was Capital Punishment, Slut Vinyl, Love Rod Exchange, and the Examples, wasn't it?
No, this was just the Examples playing some like calm thing. It wasn't some punk rock.
Okay.
They just went up and played. Yeah,
that was an incorrect memory. Please strike that from the record.
The Examples just, they got someone paid them to go up there and play at some random club. But just saying, like, this was something, that's why I'm saying it would be something completely off character with Mark. You think of more like punk and the metal.
Yeah.
And he's going to just see the Examples play some random little club up in, you know, with like 10 people or something. In fact, the Examples played my backyard in eighth grade.
Well, that's one of the tremendous things about Mark is he's down for music on any level.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at the bands that he's played with, he's been in the Mentors, he's been in Edema, he's been in Hausbruten, he's been in Cardboard Lowride. His legacy of bands, it's like, are we sure Mark hasn't been cloned like 3 or 4 times? And there's just all these different bands traveling, because he's been in so many bands and played so many shows, and he's managed to like chisel out a very successful tattoo parlor. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, I remember back in the late 80s, I played in Hausbruten for like 5 shows. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun. Right. It was like a really fun in the late 80s, 89, 90. I went and played Gilman Street. Mark invited me to play bass. And it was like, he's a cool cat. He brought a lot to the film.
Well, you know, I like people like that. Like in the running scene, I've been kind of just lumped into this whole ultra scene. But I'm a person who likes all forms of running. Like, I'm reporting on track meets and, you know, 6-day races and everything in between, because I'm kind of like Mark, and I am attracted to people who, you know, just kind of take it all in, you know, and not just get pigeonholed and just appreciate and enjoy the whole thing. So you're talking about, you got the Bones of Brundage. So you're working on the country version then, a country one sort of?
Well, sadly, I mean, that idea is, I mean, as a film guy, I kind of have to be open to like holding 8 or 9 different films in my head. I can't just focus on one, because, I mean, I can focus on one, but now because I know how to do it. Now I know how to make a film. Now I want to just kind of store these ideas. So I've been pitched on doing movies for other music scenes. Mm-hmm. I've been pitched. Some people have approached me and said, you want to do a movie on this? I've been pitched on doing a Kraftwerk documentary on the band Kraftwerk. Unfortunately, the guy just died, so that's not happening. The country western Bakersfield thing, I wanted to do it. We shot some footage on it. I shot a lot of footage on it. But here's the problem. A lot of the players in the last couple of months have passed. Like Fozzie Owen died. What was the biggest bone of contention is the fact that we had documentary maker Ken Burns, is that his name? He did a Bakersfield sound chapter right when we were about to make the decision. Are we going to do this? Are we going to make a country western sequel to Bones of Brundage? And we wanted to do it. We owed it to the community. But then when Ken Burns made his documentary, it just took all the wind out of our sails.
Yeah.
So we tried to reframe it now. And I said, how can I turn this negative into a positive? So my next great idea was, there's this song by the Rolling Stones called Girl with the Faraway Eyes. Have you heard it?
Yes.
Girl with the Faraway. It's a Bakersfield sound song, and it mentions Bakersfield. Yeah. It's not one of the Stones' best songs. It's not one of their most famous songs, but a lot of people love it. If you go to the Alley Cat at 2:00 in the morning when it's last call, right, they'll play it on there, and you know, everyone's got to clear the heck out. Everyone's drunk at the Alley Cat, yeah. Guthrie's. So it is a Bakersfield song. We own it, right? Bakersfield owns that song. And it's a Rolling Stones song. So I was thinking it'd be great to write a documentary about that song, all right? Mm-hmm. About the people who played it, the people who are familiar with it, go to Nashville, go to Oklahoma, you know, Bakersfield people, and we'll also go to England. All right? This is just how my mind works.
Yeah.
And we'll approach the Mick Jagger people, and we'll approach the Keith Richards people. And what I was thinking is, probably we're not going to get them on film. They've got so many other things to do. They're probably not going to agree to do it. However, it is kind of flattering to think, well, you know what? Here's one of our lesser known songs.
Yeah, the hook. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But here's the thing. I was thinking, we could make that documentary, or we could make a documentary about making that documentary. So basically, if we get thrown out of the manager's office, we could film like Keith Richards taking out the trash. We could like try and bomb him at a restaurant. You know, just kind of make it that kind of a guerrilla film about trying to get these guys on film, right? That was my idea. But that's, you know, I have so many ideas. I probably have 8 or 9 in my head right now that I want to pull the trigger on, but I can't, right?
I was listening to, I believe, Joe Rogan podcast, and he was talking to some guest who lives where Keith Richards is. And Keith Richards rides around town on a bicycle to soccer games and stuff.
Yeah,
that would be fun. So you just roll into wherever Keith is at the moment, and you might just catch him riding his bicycle, which is amazing because, good God, the guy's so old. I won't get on a bike because I'm afraid of killing myself. It's kind of interesting, you know, the whole documentaries. I really enjoy them. I listen to Adam Carolla a lot. Me and Adam are like the same age, have the same kind of upbringing. And, you know, he's gotten into documentaries big time. Are you familiar with Adam Carolla's documentaries?
Not really. No, I know who he is, but I haven't dug that deep.
He's really into cars and Paul Newman. So he made a Paul Newman car racing thing where Paul Newman was doing Le Mans and all these things. And then he did a Carroll Shelby movie, Ford versus Ferrari, which now is a huge movie. But that came on the backs of him putting out that movie. And he also did one on Willie T. Ribbs, which was the first black driver in NASCAR and everything. And it's kind of, and so he's kind of like, he talks about the process a lot on his shows. So I kind of just get an education on that. And he's been working, and he's always working on several of them, because one of the ones he's working on is a K-Rock one.
Yeah. Okay. So, they deserve a documentary. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's kind of weird that there hasn't been one of that sort. So now, I guess where we're at
is just developing new ideas. The problem is, I'm not exactly sure, Paul, if it's moral to actually go out and start production in this set of pandemic circumstances. I mean, I'm willing to do it. I can do it. I'm very compact. I travel light. I could actually film 6 feet away from people.
Yeah.
But it's probably a better bet to just, instead of like going to different hotels every night, taking public transport, whatever, just wait till this thing is calmed down, right?
Yeah.
Wait till it's calmed down. There's no rush. You know, it'll give me time to sort out which of the 8 different films in my head I want to make first. But it's been amazing the people that have come to me with these different ideas. Right.
Nice.
And some of them are self-generated and some of them other people have brought to me. And that's probably because we're seriously promoting the film out of town. That's another thing. I spend a lot of time promoting it in Bakersfield, but I'm also in groups all over the United States and Europe in certain parts and different punk groups. And there's lots of them. Yeah. And people are seeing it and they can see how relatable it is to their hometown.
Nice. That's very good. So that's become a lot of your day is the movie.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it right now. I'm in a position where I could actually do it. And Canada has been good to me. I mean, obviously, we're smashing the curve, so to speak. So there's a lot of really, I'm actually leaving the house now, like every other day, right? For a while, I wasn't leaving the house. I was like a recluse. And I kind of enjoyed it because I actually get good sleep. You know, our premier said, you know, don't leave the house unless you go to a pharmacy appointment or a grocery store, right? So I was going to the grocery store once, twice a week. Stay indoors, do the social media. So I hate to say it, but the pandemic, one of the silver linings is it's actually helped film because people now have, or they had, or they still do have time on their hands.
Yes.
Right? And they've got less ways to get that entertainment itch elsewhere. So they turn inwards, right?
Yeah. And well, especially like, you know, there's no product coming out because if you're doing script movies, you can't get the cast and everybody, you know, all the thousands of people that got to put together a movie just isn't happening. I'm the same way. I mean, you know, here in the United States, it's crazy. And of course, Bakersfield, the way it's handling, you know, the whole COVID. But it's interesting is that my family are a bunch of homebodies. My wife never really goes out very much and does stuff. And my kids are the same way. And I'm the only one in the house that actually goes out and about. And I'm not even going out and about. I'm still working out a lot but I use Instacart now. It's too bad they don't advertise. And I don't go in stores. I don't go out and about. And it's more just, I'm more of a, you know, I have an economics degree too. That's the thing that's crazy. Like I got a degree in biology from UC San Diego and I have a degree in economics. I'm way overeducated, but even with an understanding of biology and an understanding of statistics, understanding all this is just crazy. But I often look at it like, hey, you have to determine your level of risk. Just because the restaurants are opening around here, me and my wife, we're not going to go to them. We didn't go to them before really either, but we're not going to go into restaurants. We're not going to go into concert halls or large gatherings where people are yelling and screaming and spreading it. And so we're pretty a self-contained unit, but it's still difficult. So I can't imagine much other people having much more difficulties. I have a lot of younger friends. Unfortunately, most of the people I train with are in their 30s and 40s with kids and stuff. And, you know, not having to go to school and everything is just so, so insane. So it'll and I also want to say in the ultra world, I've met a lot of Canadians. They all come down to America to run a race. And so I've gotten immersed in the Canadian kind of world.
Oh, they're good people. They're very good. They're good people. I mean, they're peaceful people and they're not like Bakersfield people. They don't want to settle their disputes with the dust up in the streets. Yes. They don't want to do that. They want to talk about it or they just want to walk away and say sorry, right?
Yeah.
They're Bakersfield, it's like, you know, come on, let's step outside.
Right? Well, and like I said, so I specialize in these fixed time races where they'll be like on 1 mile loops. And the great about them is, you know, 24-hour to 6-day races. But the great thing is you're out there with world record holders running around you, but you're also at different times getting to hang out and talk to people. And it's really social. It's a really kind of a fun event. And, but one of the things that's kind of funny that you brought it up, and it probably goes in line with me being from Bakersfield, is I have been threatened with bodily violence several times at races by fellow race people or people affiliated with the races. And it mainly usually comes down to because there's rules and regulations and they're not being followed, or things aren't going right, and everybody else is walking around grumbling and bitching, but I actually say something. And I've actually had people cussing me out in the middle of a 6-day race, like on night 4 or 5, when I'm really tired, cussing me out and then wanting to kick my ass. And I'm like, well, go ahead. And threatening me physically and verbally, but it's probably because I'm from Bakersfield. I'm like, okay, well, if it's gonna happen, we gotta happen. Like, let's throw it out. But I've had it happen now several times, and you know, of course, they end up, you know, backing off, because one of the advantages of being a big ugly dude like myself, 250. Most of these guys are 150. So, and I just like, and I'm also like going, I'm not really afraid of you. You're some skinny. I go, I mean, I'm from Bakersfield. Yeah. Like saying, I'm from Brooklyn. I'm from Boston. You know, I think that's kind of, in fact, it's funny. They're all B towns, you know, people proud of Brooklyn tough or Boston. You know, you talk to the, you know, the Irish from Boston or whatever. And, you know, they're just kind of that New Yorker kind of mentality. So it's definitely.
Well, how old are you now?
I'm 57.
57. And you still have that kind of, you know, straight back up straight, ready to brawl attitude. You are from Bakersfield.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, like one of the individuals who threatened me, and what the thing is, the track and field rules are, if you verbally harass somebody, they're supposed to be thrown out of the race. It's just the rule. And if you obviously threaten with physical violence, you're supposed to be thrown out of the race. Plus, also, just him stopping and impeding my progress is also a track and field rule. So this guy should have been thrown out, but the race directors and all of them are a bunch of pussies. They won't enforce rules and stuff. And so this guy, you know, was threatening with bodily harm and said, whenever he ever sees me. And then, you know, what's funny is he ended up, I don't know how, he's been here in Bakersfield before. I was out walking on a Sunday morning and I'm walking because I'm on the bike path all the time. And he comes walking up to me. I was like, oh, I guess it's time for, and he just goes, yeah, you want to shake on it or make up? I'm like, oh, absolutely. I go, absolutely not. You're dead to me.
That's funny because when I see your Facebook feed and what it is you're doing with all the running and the marathons and stuff, I'm sitting there thinking that you live in this world, this holistic world of like health and peace. I was looking at that and said, you know what? Paul's kind of a, you know, a health conscious hippie, you know? And now you're telling me you like to get out there and brawl and have conflicts with these people?
Oh, no, I don't brawl, but I don't put up with any shit.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
No, I mean, if it comes to that fight, I'm fine with it. I mean, you know, but I, you know, because the best thing with the bullies, you stand up to the bully.
Yeah, well, of course. You know? I mean, you don't have to explain it to me. I know, but it's just funny how Facebook, kind of social media, kind of sanitizes what we see and presents it in a certain way. And I'm sitting there, my understanding and the way I take it in is like, well, he's doing this for health, for peace. He's probably just like as calm as a leaf on a stream, just going out there and jogging and running, getting out with nature.
Well, that's where the conflict also comes with me. And I talk about this on the podcast all the time. One of the things is a lot of people come into running later in life, and it is this, what you're talking about, you know, all unicorns and rainbows and this spiritual bullshit. No, why I got into running was I moved to Bakersfield in 8th grade. I was a good athlete, but I couldn't make any of the first, I couldn't get on the field. And so after my sophomore year, I was like, look, I'm sick and tired of sitting on the bench. I was a competitive young man. And it's like baseball, football, basketball. If the coach doesn't think you're good, you don't play. Well, you played soccer, so you know what it is. Well, I looked at my sophomore year after sitting on the bench way too much. I looked around. I said, what sports doesn't matter who the coach is? And I was like, swimming and running. Well, the people in swimming have been swimming since they were 5. And like in the Olympics, the difference between first and third place in the Olympics is usually like 4 inches. It's just 2. But I was like, hey, running's cheap. And if I win the race, I get to run to the next race. And so I quit the baseball team, walked over to the track team. And so I started running purely because I was a young man, wanted to be competitive. And I still to this day have that competitive fire. You know, I like to compete, and I don't like to beat people, but I use the competition to bring the best out of me. I flew all the way to Vermont 2 years ago in 2018 to do a 48-hour race to help promote the race to my friends. But towards the end, this guy in his 30s was trying to catch me, and he chased me the last hour, and I beat him by 60 yards in a 48-hour race.
Mazel tov. Nice.
But I come from, I'm in, because like a lot of runners are like the lonely, sad, you know, or whatever. And I'm not, it's just But I enjoy it immensely, and I enjoy a lot of the people. But there's some people and aspects of it that just get me going. So, yeah. So that's like I said. I really enjoyed the movie. So what are your future plans? Just doing this? You guys have the business kind of with this whole thing, or?
My producer lives in Long Beach. I'm up here. I have an incorporated company, and then we're gonna try and make more films. You know, that's the whole thing. It's like, this is not a good time for production because there's this virus out there. There's uncertainty. There's unrest. So now is a good time to get your ducks in a row, right? So I've written a book. I've written out some ideas of films and who I want to approach for a couple of different films. The trick is deciding which one you want to green light, right? Yeah. Because you can't, it's very difficult to do three things at once. So we had to kind of make peace with the fact that we're not doing a country western movie. There's one about the high desert. I want to make about the high desert, you know, music scene. There's one about, there was one going to be about the band 15. I don't know if you remember Crim Shrine. The guy has a tremendous story, and that ties in with the homeless problem in California. And which is definitely a timely issue because California is like overwrought with homelessness. And there's an organization called Food Not Bombs that's like, it's kind of like throwing your hand up against the tide. They're out there helping the homeless people and feeding them. But the problem is so, like, it's like a tidal wave. The Food Not Bombs, it would be a great way to approach the California home. So all these different ideas, and some of them I'm not sharing with you. Not just yet.
Oh yeah,
right. But yeah, we had to put the country western film to bed because it's been done. We had to put that idea aside. You know, eventually down the road, if I had a couple of $1,000, I'd go to England and try and, you know, do something about the girl with the faraway eyes, right? And Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Yeah. But it's one day at a time. Like I say, right now is a great time for resting, sleeping, and developing ideas and writing. Right?
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. No. I really felt into just doing more and more stuff with the podcast and YouTube, because when I started doing Zoom, I reopened my YouTube. The only problem is now YouTube used to be monetized, but now you have to have 1,000 subscribers to be monetized. Even though they do monetize your videos, they just don't give you anything. And that's kind of the one thing I talked to my young son, my middle son, Nicholas. He's a musician, a real creative. And he's always like, yeah, it just sucks because you create stuff and you just don't get any kind of reimbursement for it, you know, in this world where everybody expects everything for free. And it's kind of definitely an issue of
there was a site called realhouse.org. When we first released Bones of Brundage, it was 2 hours. We ended up cutting 20 minutes out of it, but it was 2 hours long. The original version, I think maybe you watched, it was on realhouse.org.
Yeah.
The good thing about realhouse.org is it's totally different than the streaming services. They won't advertise it for you. Real House won't do a damn thing. But if you could promote it, you could charge whatever you want and you'll get 85% of it. So if we're charging like $12 a head, right?
Yeah.
On Real House, and we are getting 85% of that, nice. That's a great way to get monetized. In fact, that whole Real House thing paid for our production. It covered all of our expenses. In general, right? So there is ways out there. You just have to find it. And a lot of it's got to do with that whole DIY ethic. Like, NoFX and Fugazi, they made a lot of money circumventing the record labels that were all major league by putting out their own music. But they had to do all their own work to promote it, right? So if you've got a good product, there's always a way to self-promote something. And in this day and age, I mean, look what you're doing. You're DIYing a podcast right now. Two guys on a Sunday afternoon just shooting the shit on video, which could actually be broadcast to people in aid of other things, right? Modern technology is there for the taking.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's why I'm doing it.
Putting our film on Prime was just the next step.
Yeah.
And there are other steps from there because films don't stay on Prime forever, right? Yeah. So it's about finding that distributor who could take it to the next level. And it's a journey, right? It's a journey, but it's a tremendous time to be a filmmaker. It's a tremendous time to be in podcasts, right?
Yeah.
It's an exciting time to be alive.
I did this. I started, I don't think of myself as a photographer, more of a documentary. I was coaching all these races. And so I took tons of photos. I've been doing photos for, since 2008. And it's just kind of like, I want to document this and then leave that. So you're, you know, ages later, people can look at these photos and see that. And it's kind of the same thing with like doing the podcast and talking to people like yourself or talking about Friday. We had a guy break the 5,000 meter world record. It was 16 years old. Ugandan kid. He came out and said months ago, I'm going to go and beat the record. And then he went and did it. And the record was a stout record. It's been around for 16 years. So every fast guy in the world has been trying to get it. And he went to Monaco and pulled it off. So I talked, I had a whole podcast talking about that and the coverage of it and just me talking into the, but you know, cause I know a lot of people just don't have the time to read or do, well, a lot of people just don't read, but they are in their cars. And actually that's one bad thing about the whole COVID is when things were normal. A lot of people spend so much time in their vehicles, so they listen to podcasts. And so probably, if anything, listenership's a little bit down because people are at home. But it's good because people are at home being creative and doing things. So it's definitely...
Well, technology is up. Technology is a lot more accessible for podcasts now. You know, with Zoom, and there's other ways to do it now. You could have a collaborative Facebook room for video. I mean, I just look around Bakersfield, and I see the other people that have podcasts for different themes. There's a lot of them. So I'm aware that technology has actually kind of become more accessible for that. And you're right, the driving thing. People don't really like to read blogs as much, but you know, everybody is always on their phone. What are they watching? Yeah. Most of the time they're watching stuff about themselves because that phone is dreadfully narcissistic. I know that because I'm always, you know, I'm on there for my own reasons, right?
Yeah.
But then again, I do take time to go enjoy somebody else's creation, right? Yeah. So there is a balance. So that podcast thing, I do believe that you're on the right track. I do believe that this visual art and connectivity is probably, you know, something good that's come out of all of this lockdown business.
Yeah. Well, and you know, this, I've only done half a dozen, because for like a year or two, it was just me talking in a microphone. And then I did the Zoom. But what I really liked about this is kind of made me even more creative and more excited because I'm talking to the Jester who owns the world American record for the most hundreds in a year. And I'm talking to other people and like, I get to just people I get to see. And he used to, you know, I used to hang out and you'd come in my store and we talk and just, and so it's kind of nice because it's a way to kind of reach out to people and, you know, have a conversation with you. And it's so great to have a conversation with you. Cause like probably haven't talked to you except at the little taping, but we can just slide right into a conversation and slide right out of it.
You and I have a lot of catching up to do.
Oh yeah. It's definitely been a, you know, in terms of, I would definitely, what I've been doing with all the podcasts and video slash is I call like this one will be 00 Nate Berg. And then hopefully, cause maybe there'll be like my regular podcast is like up to 500. This will be 00. So hopefully there'll be a 01 Nate Berg. Check in with you in the future and just talk about it.
Of course, I'm always available. Always available. Yeah. I like to talk. I do like to listen, even though I don't do enough as I should.
Well, we're both in that boat.
I'm definitely grateful you asked me to do this today. This was good for me.
Yeah, no, I just when I was going through, I've just been slowly like writing people going, hey, you want to do this? And I had a list and you popped up there. Like, oh, I just want to talk to him about the Bones of Brundage. And, you know, because my podcast is Endurance Noise and Random Musings. And this is more, you know, the random musings type of thing. But, you know, it's also, you're a testament to endurance. You've been in this game for quite some time. We both have.
It took me a while to realize what I really wanted to do. As a promoter, you're kind of a music promoter. I wanted to do it at the time because it came a lot of celebrity with that, like the money and the, you know, the work in the front door and the backstage and the big festivals and all that stuff. And I hit my ceiling with that. But it's like you're serving a different master. You're serving money as a promoter, right? Mm-hmm. So now it's taken me, I mean, like when I came to Canada, I was a boiler room telemarketer. I was good at that, right? I wasn't very honest. So I didn't like the way I looked when I went and looked in the mirror and realized what I had to do to make that money. But now that I'm finally 48 and I've discovered, hey, I can do this. I can make movies. And I'm not only that, I seem to be pretty good at it, right? And I love doing it, right? And I have all these stories to tell and I know how to be able to talk to somebody and be able to get a story out of them too. It's like, I actually enjoy this. So actually having some, and it took me a while to get here, to actually be able to do something that I enjoy.
Yeah.
It's been a heck of a journey, but I actually feel there's no anxiety now. I have no anxiety. that's work related because I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Beforehand, there was always this like, should I be doing this or should I be looking for something better?
Yeah. Right. Oh no, I totally understand that. And it's a great message to tell people, you know, find something that, you know, unfortunately sometimes it is just about putting food on the table, but there's always a way to kind of figure something out or have a side hustle. That's what Corolla says.
I will qualify everything I've said. I'm not a rich man.
Yeah. Oh no.
I'm a happy man.
I'm the same way. No, I mean, yeah, it's like Adam Carolla would say, like, you know, he was like a carpenter and then he would take classes, you know, comedy classes, and then just kept doing things and eventually something happened, but he was always, you know, he wasn't working Monday through Friday 9 to 5.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was working evenings and working nights, like me and you are both doing, and, you know, maybe not making any money, but maybe someday we'll just take off and it would be awesome to see that. And then you'll have that corn-like money and see how that, but the good thing is you won't be going to live that lifestyle that they were in their 20s because you're an older man and gotten wiser, because you're a lot healthier now than I think you've been, you know, for a while, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. I mean, I feel better. I look better. I'm thinking better. I mean, here's the thing. I'm not resentful to the people that actually have money. Right.
Because
a lot of those people that actually have money, they did it because most of them did it because they actually worked 9 to 5 and they stayed out of trouble.
Yeah.
They have the money, but they don't have the stories to tell.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
All right. I have, we and our brethren, we have the music industry types. We have the stories to tell, you know, but we just don't have the money because we've been creating these stories and staying out late and waking and all these different adventures and like, you know, being a jack of all trades, quitting something, you know, impulsively and moving around it's endless, right? It's the people that are consistent who just throw the ball and swing that scythe, you know, the scythe that the Grim Reaper has, that big axe that cuts the wheat. That's all you do. They just cut the wheat every day and let the money pile up, and they stay away from all the drama like the music industry types, right? So, that's what it takes. It takes a lot to do a business, right? But now at least we've completed a project. We have the basis in which we can move forward and complete another one. Right. And it's not a me thing. It's everybody took part, right? Everybody.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I totally get that. I mean, I saw just the little part that I did and it was great. You know, you had your people and supporting there. And so good stuff. I've kind of like wrap it up. So I'll let you go here. I really enjoyed the conversation any parting words, anything that you wanted to, how people get a hold of you or any of that stuff, if they got questions and stuff?
Best ways to get hold of you? I'm on Facebook under the Bones of Brundage page or Nathaniel Berg. Thank you, Paul, Andy, for shooting the shit. I feel we could go on for another hour, but we need to take a break. I need to eat.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Definitely. Let's stay in touch. If there's anything I could do to help, please let me know.
Okay, well, thank you, Nate, and awesome. We'll talk to you guys later.
Take care, brother.